Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and this week, as I've researched the show, I've noticed there's a plethora of debut novels getting rave reviews everywhere. Some of our most treasured titles are first-time efforts, like To Kill a Mockingbird, The Catcher in the Rye, even Gone with the Wind. Here's what I like about debut novels. Oftentimes, they're different, a bit quirky, but so very memorable, like The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. That book really stayed with me. And my guests today took two different routes to publishing their first novel. Those of you with a manuscript in the drawer, make sure to stay tuned. Let's discover some new authors together as we turn to page one of the book report. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Lighthouse begins on a North Sea ferry. This debut novel by Alison Moore was actually nominated for a Booker Prize. Impressive for a first title. Here's the story. Fuss, a middle-aged, recently separated man, is heading to Germany for a restorative walking holiday. After an encounter with an inexplicably hostile barman at a family-run hotel in Hell House, Fuss sets out on his week-long circular walk along the Rhine. As he travels, he contemplates his childhood, his complicated friendships, his parents' broken marriage, and his own. But the story he keeps coming back to, the one that affects all others, is his mother abandoning him as a boy. Recalling his first trip to Germany with his newly single father, Fuss is mindful of something he neglected to do there, an omission which now threatens to have devastating repercussions. At the end of the week, Fuss comes to the end of his pilgrimage, returning to the sanctuary of the Hell House Hotel. However, he is unaware of the events which have been unfolding there in his absence. Eve Karp narrates.
He can feel the rumble of the engine, the vibrations underfoot. He looks up at the night sky, up towards the waxing moon, inhaling deeply through his nose, as if he can catch its scent in the wind, as if he can feel its pull. Now the ramp is being raised like a drawbridge. He is reminded of the closing leaves of a Venus flytrap, but this is slower and noisier. The mooring ropes are dropped into the water, and Fuss, like a disconcerted train passenger, unable to tell whether it is his or a neighbouring train which is pulling out of the station, sees the untethered land drawing away from him. The engine chugs, and the water churns white between the dock and the outward-bound ferry. There is someone else up on the outer deck, on the far side of a life ring, a man wearing a raincoat and a hat. As Fuss glances at him, the man's hat blows off and lands in the sea in their wake. The man turns, and noticing Fuss, laughs and shouts something across the deck against the wind. His words are lost, but Fuss gives an affable laugh in response. The man moves along the railings, holding on as if he might blow away as well. Arriving at Fuss's side, the man says, "Even so, I prefer to be outside." "Yes," says Fuss, catching the smell of the man's supper coming from his mouth. "Me too." "I get a little," says the man, pressing the palm of his hand soothingly against his large stomach. "Yes," says Fuss. "Me too. I'm worse on aeroplanes." Fuss and his companion stand and watch Harwich receding, the Black Sea rising and falling in the moonlight. "Are you on holiday?" asks the man. "Yes," says Fuss. "I'm going walking in Germany." When Fuss tells the man that he will be walking at least 15 miles a day for a week, doing almost 100 miles in total, the man says, "You must be very fit." "I should be," says Fuss, "by the end of the week. I don't walk much these days." The man reaches into the inside pocket of his coat, takes out a program and hands it to Futh. "I'm on my way to a conference," he says, "in Utrecht." Futh glances at the program before passing it back, carefully in the bluster, saying, "I don't really believe in that sort of thing." "No," says the man, putting it away again. "Well, I'm undecided." He pauses before adding, "I'm also visiting my mother, who lives in Utrecht. I'm dropping in on her first. I don't get over very often. She'll have been cooking all week just for the two of us. You know how mothers are." Futh, watching the sea fill the growing gap between them and England, says, "Yes, of course." "You're just going for a week," says the man. "Yes," says Futh. "I go home on the Saturday." "Same here," says the man. "I'll have had enough by then, enough of her fussing around me and feeding me. I put on a couple of kilos every time I'm there." Futh puts his hand in his coat pocket, wrapping his fingers around his key card. "I think I'm going to go to my room now," he says. "Well," says the man, pulling back his coat cuff to check the time, "it's almost midnight." Futh admires the man's smart watch, and the man says, "It was a gift from my mother. I've told her she spends too much money on me." Futh looks at his own watch, a cheap one, a knock-off, which appears to be fast. He winds it back to just before midnight, back to the previous day. He says good night and turns away. He's halfway across the deck when there is a tannoy announcement, a warning of winds of force 6 or 7, a caution not to risk going outside. He climbs down the steps, holding on to the handrail, and steadies himself against the walls until he reaches the door, which looks like an airlock. He goes through it into the lounge. The floor is gently heaving. He feels it tilting and dropping away beneath him. He walks unsteadily across the room towards the stairs and goes down, looking for his level, following the signs pointing him down the corridors to his cabin. He lets himself in with his key card and closes the door behind him, putting his overnight bag down on a seat just inside. He takes off his coat and hangs it on a hook on the back of the door, just above the fire action notice. It is a small cabin, with not much more than the seat and a desk, a cupboard, bunk beds on the far side, and a shower room.
That was The Lighthouse by Alison Moore. Anton DeSclafani grew up in northern Florida, where she rode horses so skillfully she was able to compete nationally. She graduated from Emory University and received her MFA from Washington University in St. Louis, where she currently teaches creative writing. Her debut novel, The Yana Lassi Riding Camp for Girls, is set in the 1930s, in the midst of the Great Depression. After her mysterious role in a family tragedy, Thea Atwell, age 15, has been cast out of her Florida home, exiled to an equestrian boarding school for Southern debutantes. High in the Blue Ridge Mountains, the Yana Lassi Riding Camp is far from the free-roaming childhood Thea shared with her twin brother on their family citrus farm. Part scandalous love story, part heartbreaking family drama, the book has been hailed as a major debut from an important new writer. Welcome, Anton. It's great to have you with us on the Book Report.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thea is one of the most compelling and complex characters I've met in quite some time. Tell us about her.
Well, thank you. That's good to hear. The story started with the Yana Lassi Riding Camp for Girls with that setting, and then like 5 minutes later, the character came, and she's always been really the focus of the story, and she's always driven the story. When I started writing, I wasn't sure where their story was going to go, but Thea asserted herself at every page and really directed the story in a weird way.
All right. I loved your description of Thea's mother, her surprise upon giving birth to twins. She said, "One twin was loved and the other unexpected."
Yes.
Yeah.
So I was really interested in the idea of twins, especially then when people could have twins and not know that they were going to have twins. And I think that, it's difficult to say how much of that is Thea revising her history according to what's happened in her present life, but there was always the sense that she was unknown and her brother was loved.
Hmm. You know, in fact, I found Thea's mother not very likable. She said to her son about Thea, "She's a girl. She doesn't matter like you do." That really shocked me. Talk about that.
It's funny. I read that passage last night at an event in Tampa, and I think it shocked the audience a little bit. Well, I didn't want Thea's mother to be an entirely unlikable character. I really think of her as a product of her time, as we all are. And in that moment when she's comforting Sam, that is kind of the best comfort that she can give him. And of course, it's wrong. And you can see, I think, how Thea does the things she does, given her her mother's stance on things.
Right. I almost feel like there's a big backstory on the mother. Maybe that's going to be your next book.
Maybe so. My parents keep asking if I'm going to write a sequel. There is a big, I mean, the mother's life was very complicated. And I think as children, especially young children, you think of your parents' lives as very simple. I mean, they're just devoted to you, and they might go off and do something during the day, but they don't seem like whole people. And they start to seem like whole people as you age, of course. And I really wanted to capture that with Thea, that her mother was a person with a startling past that only becomes clear when she's away from her mother.
Hmm. Well, you write early on, and I kind of love this, that Florida is a strange place and not for everyone. As a Floridian myself, of course, I'd have to agree. But was this statement based on your opinion as one who grew up in the state?
Yes. I'm sitting in a hotel room in Florida right now, and I'm in Tampa, and I got off the plane yesterday, and I was just like met by the heat. Like, it feels like a person. It's incredible. And then I started driving around trying to find my hotel, and I got lost like 5 times. And the view is just stunning. There's the bay on either side, and you can see, like, flying in, you could see the sandbars and fish swimming around when we were close enough. Florida is unlike any other place that I've ever been. And especially southern Florida, it feels like the wilderness is constantly trying to reclaim civilization. Like, there's all those stories about subdivisions that go under because the Everglades are reasserting themselves. And then northern Florida feels like a small town in Georgia. It's such a weird place. And the thing that I always talk about when I'm explaining Florida to outsiders is that the Native Americans evaded the federal government for the longest in Florida because the federal government could not follow them into the swamp.
Right.
Which I think, like, it says it all.
You know, that's interesting that you say that, because I also feel almost that you set the book in the Depression, and that too seems like a character in the book, like an invisible villain, an illness that keeps taking people.
I like that way of, I like that characterization of it. When I was revising the book, especially, the economic collapse of 2008 had happened, and so the ways that people's lives were being constrained was I was really, really aware of that. And in writing in the 1930s, I tried to borrow some of what I was feeling and what I was observing, and put it into how Thea was living her life. I think that there's this impulse to look at the Great Depression as this thing that could never happen again, and that it's been mythologized so thoroughly in movies and literature, and I really wanted to write about the people who were in the middle of it, not the extremely wealthy or the extremely poor, but the people whose lives were going to continue, but just differently, and all the subtle ways that their lives would change.
Hmm. Now, the core of the book is an incident, of course, which we will not talk about to give it away. But before that, Thea and her twin were so connected. And after the incident, they were so disconnected.
Well, I think in a way, what happens to Thea's family would have happened to her family anyway, in that they're not as close anymore. I mean, it would have been impossible for them to remain that isolated and that close for everybody's entire lives. But what Thea does is she speeds up the separation, the disconnection, and she makes it happen in a really short period of time. And she can't, she and Sam, her twin, can no longer pretend that they're as close anymore. Like, what she does is kind of lay out everything out on the table and force Sam to choose whether or not he's going to be close to her or whether he is going to pull away from her. And it was something that was, it was hard to write in a way, because there was something about their closeness that I really grew attached to as a writer.
Hmm. Well, this is your debut novel, but share your journey of bringing it to publication.
Sure. So I worked on a first draft for 2 years. Then I took a year and revised and found an agent. And then I revised with my agent for 2.5 years, and then it sold.
Wow, and getting such big buzz right now. Congratulations on that. What's your next project?
My next project is contemporary. It is about a woman who lives in L.A. working as a screenwriter, and she returns to her small southern hometown in Georgia after her brother dies.
Hmm. All right. Is there a working title for that yet?
No. Which is odd for me, because Yanalasi, that was always, like, I had the title before I had the book, and there isn't one for this, which feels like it's like not naming your child.
All right. Well, Anton, I love this book, and I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All righty. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
And now, the book report brings you a sampling of the Yanalasi Writing Camp for Girls, performed by Adina Versen.
When I tried to look outside to the quiet street, I saw a blurred reflection of myself, lavender and awkward. We were the only people there, and my father complimented my dress twice. "You look lovely, Thea." My full name was Theodora, a family name. The story goes, Sam shortened it to Thea when we were two. The beets tasted flat and dirty against my tongue. I tried not to think about what my brother was doing while I ate. My father told me again that at the camp I would ride every day except Sunday. I thanked him. I was leaving Sasi behind in Florida, but it was just as well because I had outgrown him. I kicked his elbows when I posted. The thought of my pretty paint pony pained me terribly now. His coat, Mother always said, was distinctively beautiful, divided evenly between black and white patches. I thought of his eyes, one blue, one brown, which wasn't so unusual in horses. If white hair surrounded the eye, it was blue. Black hair, brown. Our meal, our last meal together for a year, was mostly silent. I had never before eaten alone with my father. My mother, yes, several times, and with Sam, of course. I didn't know what to say to my father. With all the trouble at home, I was afraid to say anything. "You'll come home soon," my father said, over coffee and creme brulee, "after all this mess is settled." And it was my turn to be startled by my father's behavior. I sipped my coffee quickly and singed my lips. I was only allowed a taste of mother's at home. My father rarely spoke of unpleasantness, any kind, personal or remote. Perhaps that's why I knew as little about the Depression as I did. He smiled at me, his small, kind smile, and I felt my eyes warm. When my mother smiled, you saw all her teeth. Her face revealed itself. But my father's smile was something you had to look closely for. In this moment, his smile meant he still loved me, after all I had done. I wanted him to tell me that things would be fine. But my father was not a liar. Things would not be fine. They couldn't ever be that way again. I have never loved a place again like I loved my first home, where I was born, where I lived until the mess commenced. One could dismiss my love of place by explaining that I was attached to the people who lived there, my mother, father, and brother. That is true, I did love these people, but I cannot remember my family without remembering the gardens where they walked, the sun porches where they read, the bedrooms where they retired. I loved the house separately from my family. I knew the house. It knew me. We found solace in each other. Absurd, but there was magic in that place. I confess that I was as sad to leave my home as to leave my family. I had never been away from it for more than a few nights, and I knew in my bones that it would be changed when I returned. I would be changed as well. When my parents met me again at the train station in Orlando, all that time later, they might as well have been meeting an entirely new person. I left my home, my lovely home, and was taken to the Yanalasi Writing Camp for Girls, an enclave for wealthy young women staffed by graduates of the camp awaiting marriage. I came of age, as they say, at the Yanalasi Writing Camp for Girls. But then I knew nothing about the place except that it was where my parents were sending me so they wouldn't have to see me. It was dusk when we arrived, a melancholy hour I've always hated. Under the cover of enormous oak trees, we drove up the long gravel road that seemed to go on forever. It occurred to me that it might be weeks before I traveled this road again. My father clutched the wheel and squinted, completing very carefully the task at hand, which was how he had always done things. We pulled up to a square. It was indeed called the Square, I would later learn, of birch-shingled cabins, and my father began to turn the automobile off. I looked around for another girl, but there was no one. I opened my own door. Thea, my father called, but I ignored him. I set my feet on the loamy soil, so different from the ground in Florida now, which was parched from the summer. The air smelled wet here, but not like the ocean. The ocean was always close to you in Florida, even when you lived hours away like we did. Here, you were boxed in, on all sides, by mountains. I peered up at the building in front of me while my father fiddled with the car. He would not leave it until he was sure everything was turned off properly.
We've just heard The Yanalasi Writing Camp for Girls by Anton D. Sclafani. It's 1957. Louis Aldridge is traveling back to his home in the south of England. He's straight out of jail and 19 years old. As Sadie Jones writes in The Outcast, his return will trigger the implosion, not just of a family, but of a whole community. A decade earlier, his father's homecoming was a very different affair. The war was over, and Gilbert had been demobilized. He reverted easily to suburban life, cocktails at 6:30, church on Sundays, but his wife and young son resisted the stuffy routine. Lewis and his mother escaped to the woods for picnics, just as they did in wartime days. But shockingly, after one such outing, Lewis came back without her. Not far away, Kit Carmichael keeps watch. Lewis's grief and rage are all too plain, and Kit makes a vow to help. But in her attempts to set them both free, she fails to predict the painful and horrifying secrets that must first be forced into the open. Dan Stevens narrates this portrait of small-town hypocrisy.
She made sure his room was ready. She aired it and asked Mary to make up the bed, and saw it was dusted, and then she closed the door again. It was a hot summer, and it had become a habit to leave the French doors to the garden open, and the inside was often as warm as the outside. Alice went to her room and checked her face, and then went down to the kitchen and spoke to Mary about supper. Then she sat in the drawing room by the empty grate and tried to read. The platform at Waterford was empty. Lewis walked down the steps without seeing anyone. The road had trees arching over it, and sunlight came through the branches and dappled the road. Lewis walked with his head down, and when he heard a car behind, he kept to the side, not looking. The car stopped. "Hey, I know you." He looked into the open-topped car at the blonde girl driving. It was Tamsin Carmichael, and she smiled at him. "Hello, Tamsin. I'd no idea you were back." "Well, just." "Hop in." He didn't move. "Are you getting in or not?" He got in next to her. The car was an Austin, and Tamsin wore short white gloves and a pale summer dress. Lewis didn't look at her after the first look, but out of the car at the country going by. "How's it feel?" she asked, as if he'd just scored a century in a cricket match. "You've missed absolutely nothing, I can assure you. Caroline Foster got married, but apart from that, I don't think a single thing's happened. Home, is it? If that's all right. Not exactly what you'd call a detour." Tamsin let him out at the end of his drive and drove off. The sound of her car faded. Lewis didn't think she knew what it meant to him for her to be nice like that. But then he forgot about her, because his father's house was ahead, and he was home. He walked up to the house and felt as if he was doing it in a dream. When he knocked, Alice opened the door immediately, smiling very brightly. "Lewis!" "Alice, you knew I was coming." We knew they were releasing you. Sorry. Hello. He went into the house and she shut the door and they looked at each other in the dim hall for a moment and then she kissed his cheek. You've grown, she said. We just didn't know whether to expect you. You look so different. Your room's ready. Lewis went upstairs and Alice stood in the hall, wondering if she should phone Gilbert and tell him Lewis was back. It was like having a man in her house she didn't know. He had been in prison, and she had no idea what he'd been through there, and he had never been predictable. She felt alarm, but Gilbert would have left his office already, and there was no phoning him. Lewis's bedroom was roughly the same size as his last cell in Brixton. He put his case on the bed and went over to the window and lit a cigarette and looked out at the garden. There was a blue bottle crashing against the glass. It went straight at the panes in a series of small assaults, hitting itself, trying to get out and not getting out, and trying again. The mantelpiece clock had a light metallic chime, and the sound of it striking six reached Lewis in his room. Alice started to assemble the ingredients for her jug of Pimm's, which would be ready at exactly 6:30, just before Gilbert walked through the door. She made a small one for herself as a taster to get the mix right. When Lewis heard his father's key in the door, he went to the top of the stairs. Gilbert stood in the doorway with his briefcase in his hand. Alice came out of the drawing room and watched them. Gilbert took off his hat. You're home.
Yes, sir.
Come with me. He said it quietly but with rage.
Gilbert,
come. Lewis started down the stairs to his father and followed him out of the house. They got into the car without a word. Gilbert drove quite fast towards the village, and Lewis didn't need to ask him where they were going. It was hard to be next to his father again, and to have his presence filling the car up like that. Gilbert pulled over and turned off the engine. Lewis stared down at his hands. He'd been going to make a promise. He'd been going to make his speech and his promise and reassure his father, but now he couldn't even raise his eyes, and Gilbert said, "Look, can't you?"
That was The Outcast by Sadie Jones. The literary world lost an important voice this June. Ian Banks, best-selling Scottish novelist, whose books ranged from violent crime dramas to interstellar conflicts, died at age 59. Banks had published 28 books of literary fiction and science fiction in just under 30 years. Whether space opera or paranoid thriller, his books combined lurid sex and violence, complex story structure, black humor, and frequently political subtext. Banks said his first published novel, The Wasp Factory, had been rejected six times before being released in 1984. The book, about a 16-year-old who's murdered three people and sacrifices animals, was acclaimed for its energetic prose and twist ending, but reviled for its grotesque violence. One reviewer commented, "If a nastier, more vicious, or distasteful novel appears this spring, I shall be surprised, but there is unlikely to be a better one either." The Wasp Factory went on to sell more than 1 million copies worldwide. It's the tale of the private world of Frank, just 16, who said this about himself. 2 years after I killed Blythe, I murdered my young brother Paul for quite different and more fundamental reasons than I disposed of Blythe. And then a year after that, I did for my young cousin Esmeralda, more or less on a whim. That's my score to date. 3. I haven't killed anybody for years and don't intend to ever again. It was just a stage that I was going through. Peter Kenny narrates.
I put my things down on the big table and sat down, shrugging. My father turned up the ring on the cooker under the soup pan, looking beneath the lid into the warming mixture, and then turning back to look at me. There was a layer of grey-blue smoke in the room at about shoulder level and a big wave in it, probably produced by me as I came in through the double doors of the back porch. The wave rose slowly between us while my father stared at me. I fidgeted, then looked down, toying with the wrist rest of the black catapult. It crossed my mind that my father looked worried, But he was good at acting, and perhaps that was just what he wanted me to think. So, deep down, I remained unconvinced.
"I suppose I'd better tell you," he said,
then turned away again, taking up a wooden spoon and stirring the soup. I waited.
"It's Eric."
Then I knew what had happened. He didn't have to tell me the rest. I suppose I could have thought from the little he'd said up until then that my half-brother was dead or ill or that something had happened to him. But I knew then it was something Eric had done. And there was only one thing he could have done which would make my father look worried. He had escaped. I didn't say anything, though.
"Eric has escaped from the hospital. That was what Diggs came to tell us. They think he might head back here. Take those things off the table. I've told you before."
He sipped the soup, his back still turned. I waited until he started to turn round, then took the catapult, binoculars and spade off the table. In the same flat tone, my father went on,
"Well, I don't suppose he'll get this far. They'll probably pick him up in a day or two. I just thought I'd tell you, in case anybody else hears and says anything. Get out a plate."
I went to the cupboard and took out a plate, then sat down again, one leg crossed underneath me. My father went back to stirring the soup, which I could smell now above the cigar smoke. I could feel excitement in my stomach, a rising, tingling rush. So Eric was coming back home again. That was good bad. I knew he'd make it. I didn't even think of asking the factory about it. He'd be here. I wondered how long it would take him, and whether Diggs would now have to go shouting through the town, warning that the mad boy who set fire to dogs was on the loose again. "Lock up your hounds." My father ladled some soup into my plate. I blew on it. I thought of the sacrifice poles. They were my early warning system and deterrent rolled into one. Infected, potent things which looked out from the island, warding off. Those totems were my warning shot. Anybody who set foot on the island after seeing them should know what to expect. But it looked like, instead of being a clenched and threatening fist, they would present a welcoming open hand for Eric.
"I see you washed your hands again," my father said, as I sipped the hot soup.
He was being sarcastic. He took the bottle of whiskey from the dresser and poured himself a drink. The other glass, which I guessed had been the constable's, he put in the sink. He sat down at the far end of the table. My father is tall and slim, though slightly stooped. He has a delicate face, like a woman's, and his eyes are dark. He limps now, and has done ever since I can remember. His left leg is almost totally stiff, and he usually takes a stick with him when he leaves the house. Some days, when it's damp, he has to use the stick inside too, and I can hear him clacking about the uncarpeted rooms and corridors of the house, a hollow noise going from place to place. Only here in the kitchen is the stick quieted. The flagstones silence it. That stick is the symbol of the factory's security. My father's leg, locked solid, has given me my sanctuary up in the warm space of the big loft, right at the top of the house where the junk and the rubbish are, where the dust moves and the sunlight slants, and the factory sits, silent, living and still.
We've just heard The Wasp Factory by Ian Banks. Kevin Barry's The City of Bohan is set 40 years in the future. The once great city of Ireland's west coast is infested by vice and split along tribal lines. Though there are posh parts of town, it's in the slums of Smoketown and on the eerie bogs of Big Nothing that Bohan really lives. For years, the city has been in the grip of Logan Hartnett, the dapper godfather of the Hartnett fancy gang. But there's trouble in the air. They say his old nemesis is back in town. His trusted henchman is getting ambitious, and his missus wants to give it all up and go straight. And then there's his mother. This unique visionary novel, performed by the author, blends influences from film and the graphic novel, and is peppered with calypso rhythms, accented with Celtic myth and legend.
Jenny Ching, waited beneath the May tree in the 98er Square. He approached the girl and his step was enough. She needn't look up to make the wreck. He smiled for her all the same, and it was a wry and long-suffering smile, as though to say, "More of it, Jenny." And he sat on the bench beside. He laid a hand on hers that was tiny, delicate, murderous. The bench had dead seasons of lovers' names scratched into it. "Well, girline," he said. "Cunt wapin reefed in Smoketown," she said, "was a Cusack off the Northside Rises." "And did he have it coming, Jenny?" "Don't they always," she said, "Cusacks." Logan shaped his lips thinly in agreement. "The Cusack family has always been crooked, girl," he said. Jenny Ching was 17 that year, but wise beyond it. Careful she was, and a saucy little ticket in her low riders and wedge heels, her streaked hair pineappled in a high bun. She took the butt of a stogie from the tit pocket of her white vinyl zip-up and lit it. "The Cusacks," she said. "The Cusacks gonna sulk up a wealth of vengeance by and by, and if you're asking me, like, a rake of them tossers bullin' down off the north side is the last thing Smoketown needs." "The Cusacks," he said, "are always great for the old talk, Jenny." "More than talk, I get a fear on, Mr. Hartnett," she said. "They got 3 flat blocks marked Cusack on the rises this last while, and that's 3 flat blocks full of head jobs, and they got a grow on them for rowing, you check me?" "All too well, Jenny." It is fond tradition in the city of Bohan that families from the north side rises will butt heads against families from the back trace. Logan ran the trace. He was back trace blood and bone, and his was the most ferocious power in the city that year. But the Cusacks were building strength and gumption on the rises. "What's the swerve we gonna throw, Logan?" she said. There was a canniness to Jenny. It was bred into her. Smoketown was the other side of the footbridge from the back trace, yonder across the Bohan River, and it was the Hartnett fancy at the runnings of Smoketown also. But the Cusacks were shaping for it. "I'd say we keep things moving quite swiftly against them, Jenny Sweet," he said. "'Cause they're gonna come on down anyways, like," she said. "Oh, there's no doubt to it, girl. You're going to take an eye for an eye, Cusack, or you got any bit of spunk at all, like?" Logan smiled. "You're an exceptional child, Jenny Ching," he said. She winced at the compliment. "It's very pretty to say so, Mr. Hartnett," she said. "Of course, the Cusacks shouldn't be causing the likes of us no grief in the first place, you check me? Just a bunch of rise of Scots is all they are, and they're getting so brave and lippy, like. Sending runners into S-Town. Why is it they's getting so brave all of a sudden is what we should be asking."
That was The City of Bohan by Kevin Barry. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. There are times when the book report goes way out there, like with this title by Lydia Netzer. When Maxon met Sonny, he was 7 years, 4 months, and 18 days old. Or he was 2,693 rotations of the Earth old. Maxon was different, Sonny was different, they were different together. And Shine, Shine, Shine is a different kind of story. Now, 20 years later, they're married, and Sunny wants more than anything to be normal. She's got the housewife thing down perfectly, but Maxon, a genius engineer, is on a NASA mission to the moon, programming robots for a new colony. Once they were two outcasts who found unlikely love with each other.
Now they're parents to an autistic son. And Sunny is pregnant again, and her mother is dying in the hospital, and their marriage is on the brink of imploding. What's gone wrong? Sunny wishes Maxon would turn the rocket around and come on home. When an accident in space puts the mission in peril, everything Sunny and Maxon have built hangs in the balance. Dark secrets, long-forgotten murders, and a blonde wig all come tumbling to light. And nothing will ever be the same. Jocelyn Jackson narrates this unique love story.
Each of the women, perched on stools at the kitchen island, had long, straight hair, meticulously flattened or gently curled. They clustered around the smallest one, who was crying. She clutched her mug of tea with both hands where it sat on the countertop, and her shoulders shook while she boo-hooed into it. Her friends smoothed her hair, wiped her eyes. Sunny smoothed her own hair and wiped her eyes.
"I just don't understand it," said the small one, sniffing. "He said he was going to take me to Norway this summer. To Norway!"
"Norway," echoed the one in the lime green cardigan. She rolled her eyes. "What a joke." She had a hooked nose and small eyes, but from her blowout and makeup, her trim figure and expensive shoes, people still knew that she was attractive. Her name was Rachel, but the girls called her Rach. She was the first one on the block to have a really decent home gym.
"No, I want to go to Norway," the little one corrected her. "My people are from there. It's beautiful. There are fjords."
"Jenny, it's not about Norway, honey," said Rach, the smooth loops and fronds of her golden hair cascading down her front and onto her tanned and curvy chest as she leaned over. "You're getting distracted."
"No," said Jenny, sobbing anew. "It's about that she's fooling around with. Who is she? He won't tell me."
Sunny pulled back from them. She wore a chenille wrap around her shoulders and operated the machines of her kitchen with one hand while the other rested on her pregnant belly. She went for the tea kettle, freshened Jenny's tea, and handed her a tissue. These were Sunny's best friends, Jenny and Rach. She knew that they were having a normal conversation, this conversation about Jenny's husband and his infidelity. It was a normal thing to talk about. But as she stood there in her usual spot, one hand on the tea kettle, one hand on her belly, she noticed an alarming thing. A crack in the wall right next to the pantry. A crack in this old Georgian wall.
"It's not really about her either, Jenny, whoever she is," said Rach.
Sunny gave Rach a stern glance behind the other women's head. Rach returned it with eyebrows raised in innocence.
"He's a jerk," Jenny said. "That's what it's about."
And she blew her nose. Sunny wondered if her friends had noticed the crack. It raged up the wall, crossing the smooth expanse of buttercream-colored plaster, ripping it asunder. The crack had not been there yesterday, and it already looked wide. It looked deep. She thought about the house, split down a terrible zigzag, one half of the pantry split from the other. Bags of organic lentils, mason jars of beets, root vegetables. What would she do? But Jenny wasn't done crying.
"I just don't know what I'm going to do," she burbled for the third time. "I have the children to think about. How could he let me find this out? How could he not be more careful?"
Sunny imagined the house falling apart, with her as the fault line. Maybe with Maxon in space, the house had given up on maintaining appearances. Maybe it would crumble into the earth without him, without the person standing in the husband spot. Everything changes. Everything falls. Jenny's husband, rockets to the moon, the wall containing the pantry. "Shh," said Rach. She reached for the remote, turning up the volume on the kitchen TV. Sunny saw that the microwave read 12 o'clock. She pulled the wrap tightly around her and two fingers fluffed up the bangs on her forehead. On the screen, the news was starting up.
"Oh," said Jenny, "time for Les Weathers."
"Now there's a man who would never do you wrong," said Rach, cocking her head and winking at the set. The women watched wordlessly for a few minutes while a tall, blonde man with a squared-off face and twinkling blue eyes reported on a local fire.
We've just heard Shine, Shine, Shine by Lydia Netzer. Deb Pines writes mysteries by day and acclaimed in-your-face headlines for the New York Post by night. One of her headlines recently won top honors from the Associated Press, the Deadline Club, and the New York Press Club. Remember the JetBlue pilot who had a mid-flight mental breakdown? Deb's headline for the story was, "This is your captain, freaking." Deb grew up in Miami Beach. After graduating from Brown University, she worked as an award-winning reporter for several newspapers, including the Indianapolis Star and the New York Law Journal. Then she got bitten by the mystery writing bug. Deb has just self-published In the Shadow of Death, a Chautauqua murder mystery. It's a twisty whodunit, a fun summer read for the beach or when you're on the porch in Chautauqua. And more on that when we speak to the author. Welcome, Deb, and thanks for joining us on the Book Report.
Thank you for having me. It's really fun.
Get us started on the story of In the Shadow of Death by introducing us to Mimi Goldman.
Okay. Well, Mimi Goldman is, I like to say, a version of me, but younger, braver, and prettier. She's a former New York City reporter, so she had worked for the New York Post, and then she moves to the middle of nowhere, which is Chautauqua, New York, thinking she's going to have a quieter life there working for the local newspaper. She ends up covering a community race. When someone drops dead at the community race, she's the only one who suspects foul play, and then the story begins from there.
All right. Well, tell us about Chautauqua and why you chose to set a murder mystery there.
Chautauqua is one of my most favorite places in the world. It's a beautiful spot in far western New York State. So even though it's in New York, it's very far from New York City. It's 400 miles east of New York City, but it's kind of close to the Midwest, 400 miles west of New York City and 60 miles east of Ohio. So it's really pretty far western corner of New York State. And it's a quirky spot. It's beautiful. It's physically beautiful. It's on a lake. It's a historic spot as well. It began as a retreat for Methodist Sunday school teachers in 1874, and now it's evolved into a spot with a 9-week summer season of lectures and concerts, and some still true to its roots, church services. And so why did I set a murder mystery there? Well, I like the idea of murder mysteries and horror stories that are set in, like, innocent places where someone has something horrific happen in, like, an unspoiled spot. A comedian came there and asked why Chautauqua even needs a police force. He said he asked to arrest people with impure thoughts. And so it's an innocent spot, like having a serpent in the Garden of Eden.
I know you began working on the manuscript in the 90s, then you set it aside. What was it like to start working on it again, and did you make any significant changes?
I had a lot of fun coming back to it. I wrote it in my late 30s, early 40s, and now, let's just say it's 20 years later, and I enjoyed seeing how I thought when I was younger. And one change I definitely made was at that time, I made the older people in the book in their 60s. Now, as I'm approaching 60, I thought that's not very old. I've made them in their 80s.
Well, I understand this is your first published novel, but not the first manuscript you've written. Share that story.
It's probably the fifth mystery that I have written. I tried to go through the front door, the traditional route, getting an agent, selling it to a publisher, and I didn't have any. Mine is a familiar story. I had some near misses. I had two agents, big-time agents, and like people in many art fields, I never succeeded in getting it published through the front door, so I'm now taking matters in my own hands.
And what are the most important tips you would share with listeners who have a manuscript and are thinking about self-publishing?
I think now is the time for self-publishing. I think for years it was, you know, kind of cool to make an indie film or to make your own homemade artisanal cheese or wine, and there was a stigma to self-publishing your own book. But I think I've been welcomed by people, you know, who have self-published, and so I do the same. If anybody's out there wanting to self-publish, I think now's the time. It seems like it's harder to go through a traditional publisher, yet easier to go through the self-publishing route. And so there's a lot to be read online, but if anybody wants to contact me, I'd be happy to answer questions on how I've done it at chautauquamystery@gmail.com, or, you know, just follow a lot of the steps that I've followed doing a Kindle book and also Amazon, they call it Create Space, self-published printed book.
All right. And where can listeners find your book when they want to read it?
Okay. Well, like I said, you can find the ebook version on Amazon and also through Kindle Books. The printed version is going to be available in the next couple days also through Amazon or through something called Create Space.
How important is it to build a network when you have to market your book?
I am learning that as I go, but it does seem to be very important, and I'm trying to get the network through Facebook and through blogs, bloggers who write about Chautauqua, bloggers who write about mysteries, and I'm also trying to get a network of people who love Chautauqua as much as I do, you know, who apparently 150,000 people go there each summer, and I'm hoping to speak to some of those people when I'm up there. One of the great things about the self-publishing is you don't have to have a blockbuster that appeals to everyone, which is what a lot of the major publishing houses seem to be looking for. If you have a niche audience, if you can also connect with them through some other way, you can have a book that would bring a lot of pleasure to that niche audience that you should also try to market to.
So are you already at work on another Mimi Goldman mystery?
I am. She is older, just a little bit older, still hasn't caught up to me. But now that I'm writing headlines for the New York Post and working on the copy desk, I'm thinking it's fun to have Mimi Goldman solve crimes and also have some jokey headlines in between, same as I do in my own life. I'd like to just mention one other thing about self-publishing and about my decision, and that's just I take the subway every day to work in New York City, and when I get on the train at 103rd and Broadway, lately there's some terrific musicians, some young guys playing reggae music, and I would say that they might not be able to command a giant venue like Madison Square Garden, but they add a lot of pleasure to my day when I hear them playing on the subway platform. And that's the same kind of thing I'm hoping for, is I might not be able to have a blockbuster hit that some major publishing house wants, but I feel like I could add pleasure to a lot of people's days if they want a charming whodunit to read that's very readable in the summer, or if they want to be transported to Chautauqua, a beautiful spot, and get a kick out of having a murder mystery set there. That's what I'm hoping to do, is to provide a little pleasure to an audience that's out there.
Well, I'm thinking that In the Shadow of Death is step one on your way to blockbusterhood.
All right. Well, thank you. I hope you're right.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Deb, for stopping by the Book Report. In Tell the Wolves I'm Home, a striking literary debut, Carol Rivka Brunt unfolds a moving story of love, grief, and renewal as two lonely people become the unlikeliest of friends. 1987. There's only one person who has ever truly understood 14-year-old June Elbus, her uncle, the renowned painter Finn Weiss. Shy at school and distant from her older sister, June can only be herself in Finn's company. He is her godfather, confidant, and best friend. So when he dies of a mysterious illness her mother can barely speak about, June's world is turned upside down. But Finn's death brings his surprise acquaintance into June's life, someone who will help her to heal and to question what she thinks she knows about Finn, her family, and her own heart. Amy Rubinet performs this tender story of love lost and found.
It was December now, the week before Christmas, and we were stuck in traffic near the George Washington Bridge. Greta turned around in her seat to look at me. She gave me a twisty little smile and reached into her coat pocket to pull out a scrap of mistletoe. She'd done this for the last two Christmases, carried a piece of mistletoe around to pounce on people with. She took it to school with her and terrorized us at home with it. Her favorite trick was to sneak up behind our parents and then leap up to hold it over their heads. They were not the kind to show affection out in the open, which is why Greta loved to make them do it. In the van, Greta waved the mistletoe around in the air, brushing it right up into my face. "You wait, June," she said. "I'll hold this over you and Uncle Finn, and then what'll you do?" She smiled at me, waiting. I knew what she was thinking. I'd have to be unkind to Finn or risk catching AIDS, and she wanted to watch me decide. Greta knew the kind of friend Finn was to me. She knew that he took me to art galleries, that he taught me how to soften my drawings of faces just by rubbing a finger along the pencil lines. She knew that she wasn't part of any of that. I shrugged. "He'll only kiss my cheek." But even as I said it, I thought of how Finn's lips were always chapped to shreds now, how sometimes there would be little cracks where they'd started to bleed. Greta leaned in, resting her arms on the back of her seat. "Yeah, but how do you know that the germs from a kiss can't seep in through the skin of your cheek? How can you be sure they can't somehow swim into your blood, right through your open pores?" I didn't know, and I didn't want to die. I didn't want to turn gray. I shrugged again. Greta turned around in her seat, but even from behind, I could tell she was smiling. It started to sleet, and the little nuggets of wet ice splatted against the window as we drove through the streets of the city. I tried to think of something good to say back to Greta, something to let her know that Finn would never put me in danger. I thought about all the things Greta didn't know about Finn, like the way he'd let me know the portrait was just an excuse, how he'd seen the look on my face the very first time we'd gone down for the painting sessions, how he'd waited for my mother and Greta to go ahead into the living room, and in that moment, when it was only the two of us in the narrow hallway inside Finn's apartment door, he'd put his hand on my shoulder, leaned in, and whispered in my ear, "How else could I get all these Sundays with you, crocodile?" But that was something I would never tell Greta. Instead, when we were in the dim parking garage climbing out of the van, I blurted out, "Anyway, skin's waterproof." Greta pressed her door closed gently, then walked around the van to my side. She stood there for a few seconds staring at me, at my big, clumsy body. She tugged the straps of her backpack tight against her little sparrow's shoulders and shook her head. "Believe what you want," she said, turning away and heading for the stairs. But that was impossible, and Greta knew it. You could try to believe what you wanted, but it never worked. Your brain and your heart decided what you were going to believe, and that was that, whether you liked it or not.
That was a sampling of Tell the Wolves I'm Home by Carol Rivka Brunt. Readers, I think you'll agree that was quite the mix of stories. I know I'm already looking forward to next titles from this illustrious group. If your book group is searching for new book ideas, remember to check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks for joining me today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.